H.P. Lovecraft's The Case of Charles Dexter Ward. Read and performed by William E. Hart. Chapter 2. An Antecedent and a Horror. 4. By the autumn of 1770, Whedon decided that the time was ripe to tell others of his discoveries, for he had a large number of facts to link together and a second eyewitness to refute the possible charge that jealousy and vindictiveness had spurred his fancy. As his first confidant, he selected Captain James Matthewson of the Enterprise, who on the one hand knew him well enough not to doubt his veracity, and on the other hand was sufficiently influential in the town to be heard in turn with respect. The colloquy took place in an upper room of Sabin's Tavern near the docks, with Smith present to corroborate virtually every statement, and it could be seen that Captain Matthewson was tremendously impressed. Like nearly everyone else in the town, he had had black suspicions of his own anent Joseph Kerwin. Hence, it needed only this confirmation and enlargement of data to convince him absolutely. At the end of the conference, he was very grave, and enjoined strict silence upon the two younger men. He would, he said, transmit the information separately to some 10 or so of the most learned and prominent citizens of Providence, ascertaining their views and following whatever advice they might have to offer. Secrecy would probably be essential in any case, for this was no matter that the town constables or militia could cope with, and above all else the excitable crowd must be kept in ignorance, lest there be enacted in these already troublous times a repetition of that frightful Salem panic of less than a century before which had first brought Kerwin hither. The right persons to tell, he believed, would be Dr. Benjamin West, whose pamphlet on the late transit of Venus proved him a scholar and keen thinker, Reverend James Manning, president of the college which had just moved up from Warren and was temporarily housed in the new King Street schoolhouse awaiting the completion of its building on the hill above Presbyterian Lane, ex-governor Stephen Hopkins, who had been a member of the Philosophical Society at Newport and was a man of very broad perceptions, John Carter, publisher of the Gazette, all four of the Brown brothers, John, Joseph, Nicholas, and Moses, who formed the recognized local magnates, and of whom Joseph was an amateur scientist of parts, old Dr. Jabez Bowen, whose erudition was considerable, and who had much first-hand knowledge of Kerwin's odd purchases, and Captain Abraham Whipple, a privateer's man of phenomenal boldness and energy who could be counted on to lead in any active measures needed. These men, if favorable, might eventually be brought together for collective deliberation, and with them would rest the responsibility of deciding whether or not to inform the governor of the colony, Joseph Wanton of Newport, before taking action. The mission of Captain Matthewson prospered beyond his highest expectations, for whilst he found one or two of the chosen confidants somewhat skeptical of the possible ghastly side of Whedon's tale, there was not one who did not think it necessary to take some sort of secret and coordinated action. Kerwin, it was clear, formed a vague potential menace to the welfare of the town and colony, and must be eliminated at any cost. Late in December 1770, a group of eminent townsmen met at the home of Stephen Hopkins and debated tentative measures. Whedon's notes, which he had given to Captain Matthewson, were carefully read, and he and Smith were summoned to give testimony anent details. Something very like fear seized the whole assemblage before the meeting was over, though there ran through that fear a grim determination which Captain Whipple's bluff and resonant profanity best expressed. They would not notify the governor, because a more than legal course seemed necessary. With hidden powers of uncertain extent apparently at his disposal, Kerwin was not a man who could safely be warned to leave town. Nameless reprisals might ensue, and even if the sinister creature complied, the removal would be no more than the shifting of an unclean burden to another place. The times were lawless, and men who had flouted the king's revenue forces for years were not the ones to balk at sterner things when duty impelled. Kerwin must be surprised at his Pawtuxet farm by a large raiding party of seasoned privateersmen and given one decisive chance to explain himself. If he proved a madman, amusing himself with shrieks and imaginary conversations in different voices, he would be properly confined. If something graver appeared, and if the underground horrors indeed turned out to be real, he and all with him must die. It could be done quietly, and even the widow and her father need not be told how it came about. While these serious steps were under discussion, there occurred in the town an incident so terrible and inexplicable that for a time little else was mentioned for miles around. In the middle of a moonlight January night with heavy snow underfoot, there resounded over the river and up the hill a shocking series of cries which brought sleepy heads to every window, and people around Wabasset Point saw a great white thing plunging frantically along the badly cleared space in front of the Turk's Head. There was a baying of dogs in the distance, but this subsided as soon as the clamor of the awakened town became audible. Parties of men with lanterns and muskets hurried out to see what was happening, but nothing rewarded their search. The next morning, however, a giant, muscular body, stark naked, was found on the jambs of ice around the southern piers of the Great Bridge, where the long dock stretched out beside Abbott's Distill House, and the identity of this object became a theme for endless speculation and whispering. It was not so much the younger as the older folk who whispered, for only in the patriarchs did that rigid face with horror-bulging eyes strike any chord of memory. They, shaking as they did so, exchanged furtive murmurs of wonder and fear, for in those stiff, hideous features lay a resemblance so marvelous as to be almost an identity, and that identity was with a man who had died full 50 years before. Ezra Whedon was present at the finding, and remembering the baying of the night before, set out along Wabasset Street and across Muddy Dock Bridge whence the sound had come. He had a curious expectancy, and was not surprised when, reaching the edge of the settled district where the street merged into the Pawtuxet Road, he came upon some very curious tracks in the snow. The naked giant had been pursued by dogs and many booted men, and the returning tracks of the hounds and their masters could be easily traced. They had given up the chase upon coming too near the town. Whedon smiled grimly, and as a perfunctory detail traced the footprints back to their source. It was the Pawtuxet farm of Joseph Kerwin, as he well knew it would be, and he would have given much had the yard been less confusingly trampled. As it was, he dared not seem too interested in full daylight. Dr. Bowen, to whom Whedon went at once with his report, performed an autopsy on the strange corpse, and discovered peculiarities which baffled him utterly. The digestive tracts of the huge man seemed never to have been in use, whilst the whole skin had a coarse, loosely knit texture impossible to account for. Impressed by what the old men whispered of this body's likeness to the long-dead blacksmith Daniel Green, whose great-grandson Aaron Hoppin was a supercargo in Kerwin's employ, Whedon asked casual questions till he found where Green was buried. That night a party of 10 visited the Old North Burying Ground opposite Herndon's Lane and opened a grave. They found it vacant, precisely as they had expected. Meanwhile, arrangements had been made with the post riders to intercept Joseph Kerwin's mail, and shortly before the incident of the naked body there was found a letter from one Jedediah Orne of Salem which made the cooperating citizens think deeply. Parts of it, copied and preserved in the private archives of the Smith family where Charles Ward found it, ran as follows. I delight that you continue in the getting at old matters in your way, and do not think better was done at Mr. Hutchinson's in Salem Village. Certainly, there was nothing but the liveliest awfulness in that which H. raised up from what he could gather only a part of. What you sent did not work, whether because of anything missing, or because the words were not right for my speaking or your copying. I alone am at a loss. I have not the chemical art to follow Borellus, and own myself confounded by the 7th book of the Necronomicon that you recommend. But I would have you observe what was told to us about taking care whom to call up, for you are sensible what Mr. Mather writ in the Magnalia of blank, and can judge how truly that horrendous thing is reported. I say to you again, do not call up any that you cannot put down, by the which I mean any that can in turn call up somewhat against you, whereby your powerfulest devices may not be of use. Ask of the lesser, lest the greater shall not wish to answer, and shall command more than you. I was frighted when I read of your knowing what Ben Zariat Natmick had in his ebony box, for I was conscious who must have told you. And again I ask that you shall write me as Jedediah and not Simon. In this community a man may not live too long, and you know my plan by which I came back as my son. I am desirous you will acquaint me with what the black man learnt from Sylvanus Cassidius in the vault, under the Roman wall, and will be obliged for the lending of the manuscript you speak of. Another and unsigned letter from Philadelphia provoked equal thought, especially for the following passage. I will observe what you say respecting the sending of accounts only by your vessels, but cannot always be certain when to expect them. In the matter spoke of, I require only one more thing, but wish to be sure I apprehend you exactly. You inform me that no part must be missing if the finest effects are to be had, but you cannot but know how hard it is to be sure. It seems a great hazard and burthen to take away the whole box, and in town, i.e., St. Peter's, St. Paul's, St. Mary's, or Christ Church, it can scarce be done at all. But I know what imperfections were in the one I raised up October last, and how many live specimens you were forced to employ before you hit upon the right mode in the year 1766. So will be guided by you in all matters. I am impatient for your brig, and inquire daily at Mr. Biddle's wharf. A third suspicious letter was in an unknown tongue and even an unknown alphabet. In the Smith Diary found by Charles Ward, a single oft-repeated combination of characters is clumsily copied, and authorities at Brown University have pronounced the alphabet Amharic or Abyssinian, although they do not recognize the word. None of these epistles was ever delivered to Kerwin, though the disappearance of Jedediah Orne from Salem, as recorded shortly afterward, showed that the Providence men took certain quiet steps. The Pennsylvania Historical Society also has some curious letters received by Dr. Shippen regarding the presence of an unwholesome character in Philadelphia. But more decisive steps were in the air, and it is in the secret assemblages of sworn and tested sailors and faithful old privateersmen in the brown warehouses by night that we must look for the main fruits of Whedon's disclosures. Slowly and surely a plan of campaign was under development which would leave no trace of Joseph Kerwin's noxious mysteries. Kerwin, despite all precautions, apparently felt that something was in the wind, for he was now remarked to wear an unusually worried look. His coach was seen at all hours in the town and on the Pawtuxet Road, and he dropped little by little the air of forced geniality with which he had latterly sought to combat the town's prejudice. The nearest neighbors to his farm, the Finners, one night remarked a great shaft of light shooting into the sky from some aperture in the roof of that cryptical stone building with the high, excessively narrow windows, an event which they quickly communicated to John Brown in Providence. Mr. Brown had become the executive leader of the select group bent on Kerwin's extirpation, and had informed the Finners that some action was about to be taken. This he deemed needful because of the impossibility of their not witnessing the final raid, and he explained his course by saying that Kerwin was known to be a spy of the customs officers at Newport, against whom the hand of every Providence shipper, merchant, and farmer was openly or clandestinely raised. Whether the ruse was wholly believed by neighbors who had seen so many queer things is not certain, but at any rate the Finners were willing to connect any evil with a man of such queer ways. To them Mr. Brown had entrusted the duty of watching the Kerwin farmhouse, and of regularly reporting every incident which took place there.